From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, talk of racial epithets directed at the Orioles' Adam Jones by Red Sox fans at Fenway Park. Governor Charlie Baker says that's unacceptable.
There's no place for this in society. There's no place for it in sports. It shouldn't be tolerated. And I'm glad the guy was found and ejected.
Also today, the transit startup Bridge closes shop. But does that mean that Boston has to give up on the idea of a smart, flexible, on-demand city bus system? And financial journalist Duff McDonald, he's got a searing critique of Harvard Business School.
HBS was uniquely positioned to help capitalism stay honest. And instead, they just early on said, you know what, forget it.
But is that fair? Certainly, Harvard graduates some of the brightest minds in business, but can it also be held responsible for what McDonald calls the moral failure of the MBA elite? All that coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Red Sox president Sam Kennedy said today that the Sox organization believes Orioles center fielder Adam Jones and his allegations that last night some Sox fans hurled racist taunts at him and that one fan even threw a bag of peanuts at Jones. Here's Sam Kennedy today on WEEI Radio.
The reports did not specifically reference racial taunting. However, I want to be very clear. We take Adam Jones at his word.
Well, joining us now with more is Shira Springer. She's WBUR sports and society reporter. Hi there, Shira.
Hello.
Also with us is Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN and author of Shutout, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston. Howard, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Shira, let me just start with you. Obviously, an unpleasant, ugly situation even last night at Fenway Park. What more are the Sox saying today?
Well, basically, they're still investigating the incident. But the main facts are that there were fans, they say a few ignorant fans, who were hurling racial epithets at Adam Jones, and that one fan did indeed hit him with a bag of peanuts. But they are trying to get down to the bottom of it. There were a number of ejections last night. It doesn't surprise me, since it was a chilly evening at the ballpark, and that tends to drive up the alcohol usage. So that's where things are now. I think they are, one, investigating what exactly happened at the ballpark last night, and two, trying to determine what other policies need to be put in place security-wise and in terms of player protection-wise in the future.
Right. And I see a statement that was released by the Red Sox as well. They're saying that the Red Sox want to publicly apologize to Adam Jones and the entire Orioles organization for what occurred at Fenway Park Monday night. I mean, is that significant that the Sox are going so far as to apologize?
Yeah, I think so, in the sense that they felt that, you know, they got to take Adam Jones at his word before the whole investigation has concluded, and they want to be proactive about this. I think part of it is the fact that they are going to play the Orioles again tonight, so you don't want this festering and lingering and perhaps getting exacerbated on the field tonight and perhaps off the field in the stands tonight. So they had to take some action to clear the air a bit before the two teams resume play this evening.
Now, Howard, let me turn to you, because obviously you've written a great deal about Boston, baseball, and race. I just want to read another line here from the Sox statement today. They say, the Red Sox have zero tolerance for such inexcusable behavior, and our entire organization and our fans are sickened by the conduct of an ignorant few. I mean, react to what happened last night. How does this incident sort of settle with you in terms of the larger history of the Red Sox and race?
Well, the Red Sox have zero tolerance of it today, just like the Red Sox have zero tolerance of it last year when David Price talked about having to go through this from his own home fans, just like the Red Sox have had zero tolerance of it every time it happens and then the next time it happens. This is something that hasn't gone away with this fan base, and it's not. And I think people want to make some sort of comparison. Well, does this happen in New York? Sure, it happens in New York. Does it happen in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Denver? Sure, it happens. Wherever there are people, there are going to be disagreement, and there's always going to be some sort of conflict. However, Boston has a special history. Boston's got a special place in its relationship with African Americans in terms of that team has a special relationship. So you can't compare. It's almost like talking to little kids. Well, what about what Johnny did? Well, I'm not talking about Johnny. I'm talking about you. And so when you're dealing with the Red Sox, the history of it, the history of the city, all of it sort of comes together. And I think what's really sort of disappointing about this as well is the fact that Adam Jones was playing for Team USA in the World Baseball Classic. Mm-hmm. There are very few players in the game who are as popular as he. And on the one hand, you've got a rivalry, and as Shira said too, you've got the alcohol flowing, and so it's sort of a perfect storm that something was going to happen. But my initial reaction was, as usual, because I don't think the Red Sox or Red Sox fans in general really, really want to confront this, that this is why it keeps happening. Normally what they do is there's the media brigade of trying to diffuse what happened instead of confronting what happened.
Let me just bring Shira back in here.
Yeah, I mean, I think Howard is exactly right to talk about the history of this organization. Let's not forget that the Red Sox were the last major league team to integrate when they put Pumpsy Green on the roster in 1959. You know, they had a shot at Jackie Robinson, and basically their owner at the time said no. And many people think of, you know, Tom Yawkey as a racist owner. So there's that institutional history here with the Red Sox. And I can remember a player that I covered, Mo Vaughn, talking to high school students about racism that he experienced. And I mean, it's not just the Red Sox, too. It goes out to the broader city. I mean, you think of, African-American athletes, professional athletes who called Boston home. A legendary player like Bill Russell experiencing, racism in this city. So I think there's both the Red Sox institutional history there, and as well as the larger history in Boston of professional black athletes experiencing racism. And so that's why this incident gets so much attention.
Yeah, and also, Sherrod, you've got it, but it's not just that. And you were there with Mo. It's also something else, and that is it's easy to dismiss a 1945 tryout. I mean, World War II wasn't even over yet, so it's like that was a really long time ago. Okay, you can dismiss it that way. And they, could have been the first team to integrate and said they were the last with Pumpsy Green in 59. In 59, that was a long time ago. But here's the real thing with the Red Sox. The Red Sox did not sign a black free agent until 1992.
Mm.
And so what you're also saying is that when you're signing a free agent, you have the black player who has to choose to come here. And free agency began in 1975. So between 1975 and 1992, not a single black person who played Major League Baseball chose to come to Boston.
And there's more to that too, Howard, right? It's not that they didn't choose. There were some players who actually, if I recall correctly, had it written into their contracts that they could, and didn't Ken Griffey Jr. too, I believe, had it written into their contracts that they couldn't be traded to Boston because they didn't want to play here. And remember the first go-around with Kevin Garnett, there was talk of that he didn't want to come to the city because he was concerned about how or whether they accepted black athletes. Now, he got past that, but this is a lingering concern for black athletes who are out there.
So let me just ask you both, and I know this may be an unpopular question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I mean, I take all of the examples, potent and real, that both of you have brought in terms of the Red Sox history and race, but are we at a place now where, I mean, can we legitimately say that the actions of maybe a few bad actors last night is an unfair tarnishing of Red Sox fans and even the organization as a whole?
No.
No? Okay.
No,
tell
no.
me more, Howard.
And I'll tell you why. It's because when you have a culture, it is your responsibility to be proactive in crushing that culture if it makes you look bad.
So what should the Sox do now to then crush that culture now?
Well, I think they've got to do a few things. I think the first thing they have to do is they've got to, you can't just eject a guy. You either lose, you can't be back in the ballpark for 5 years or 2 years or however many years. You've got to do something more. I think that's the first thing. And I think the second thing that you do as well is that let's not also forget that the flagship station of the Red Sox, WEEI, is very well known for their morning show of being a very intolerant show.
Yeah. And she was shaking her head in vigorous agreement.
I'm saying that's to put it mildly.
Yeah.
Both on a racist terms and sexist terms.
Kind. Mm-hmm. Exactly. On all levels. And have the Red Sox ever gone out of their way to use their power to tone it down? That radio station is speaking to the fan base.
Yeah. I know I'm going to jump in. Howard, sorry. I'm sorry to cut you off, but she's got to run off and do some more reporting here. So I'm going to give you one last say here.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, today, who gets the big sort of interview but WEI with the Red Sox president? So not only are they not going on or sort of disciplining in some way the flagship station, they're giving them the big scoop of the day. And I also think, you know, Howard, you are echoing something that Adam Jones said about the severity of the punishment for these fans. That's where it has to start. It's not just about a 2-year or 3-year ban or whatever. It should be a lifetime ban. And Adam Jones actually brought up the possibility of fining fans, and I think that's an interesting way you could take this. You know, not only are they banned, but they have to pay for their bad behavior. And we'll see if that sort of changes the behavior in stadiums and perhaps gets rid of this type of behavior.
If you care, do something about it.
Well, yeah. And do something strong. Take strong action.
And fast, right?
Yes.
Howard Bryant, ESPN and ESPN senior writer and NPR correspondent, thank you so much for joining us today, Howard.
Thank you.
And Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Thank you, Shira.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a few years ago, Matthew George wondered, in the ride-hailing era, why couldn't buses be smarter, too? So he founded Bridge, the bus company with flexible, demand-based routes and pricing. In other words, the future of the city bus. Well, this week, though, Bridge announced that it's shutting down. An expansion deal with an auto manufacturer fell through, unfortunately. However, we are still intrigued by the idea of the future of the city bus. And at one time, by the way, Bridge and the MBTA were even talking about the company possibly providing late-night weekend service. So again, we wonder, what can the MBTA still learn or even adopt from Bridge's experiment? Well, joining me now in the studio is Matthew George. He's the founder and CEO of Bridge. Matthew, it's good to have you back.
Thanks so much.
Although I'm sorry to hear about the company folding.
Hey, we'll live to fight another day.
All right. Well, also with us is James Aloisi. He's former state transportation secretary and now currently a principal at the Pemberton Square Group. Jim's good to have you back as well.
It's nice to be with you both.
Okay. So, Matthew, let's just start with sort of the basics. Can you just give us the reason why that Bridge, because I always thought those Bridge buses were full and all of a sudden... No more company. What happened?
They were. It would be a. I think it would be a lot less tragic if that was actually sort of the underlying reason. So earlier in the year, especially with the auto manufacturers starting to create partnerships between themselves and innovative transportation companies, we started to get a tremendous amount of inbound from car companies looking to fill out the dance card of partnerships in the space. We made the strategic decision, fateful, to push back a Series B financing round to be able to form a partnership with one of those companies.
So rather than venture funding, you were going to partner with an auto manufacturer.
Absolutely. Okay. For the same, if not a little bit more amount of money, but also access to fleet, to access to autonomous research and a bunch of those other things that they're working on. We narrowed it down to three companies and then to one. And we originally had a close date of March 31st. And a week of delay became 2 weeks of delay, became 4 weeks of delay, which ate into our cash buffer. And because of a lockout agreement, we couldn't restart a conversation with another auto manufacturer. And thus why I'm talking to you here today as a eulogy.
rather than a celebration of perhaps something new, but it still can be that. But before we turn to this question of sort of lessons learned more broadly about transit, I mean, how was the business doing? Was there high demand for the Bridge buses? Was this model of having a smart city bus, on-demand, flexible pricing, flexible routes, was it working?
Yeah, that's one of the things we're most proud of, especially looking back. The Bridge fleet deployed in about a million different ways, literally a million different ways to meet demand throughout Boston, one day to the next, right? The routes and the schedules and things like that were very different. So we were really the first to actually be able to go out there and say, hey, we're deploying transit in a way that's a little bit different, right? Our average commuter saved about 40% of their time compared with traditional right, modes of mass transit. And we were able to deliver it profitably on some of our most mature routes. So, you know, overall, we were growing about 1,000% year to year. But at the end of the day, it's a business with huge assets, right? Big buses.
The buses, yeah.
And at the end of the day, the barrier to scale was significant. We needed that partnership to really get over it.
Okay, barrier to scale. So they needed money to grow, Jim. I mean, I think an old hand at transportation might have been able to say, it's expensive to run a transit company no matter what, right?
Yeah, are you calling me an old hand? Or?
I am.
So it is. I mean, one of the takeaways, I think, from this whole experience, and I have given Matt and his team a lot of credit for you know, nothing venture, nothing gained, as I tweeted out the other day, and they should be credited for giving it a try. But it highlights the importance of robust, stable revenue to running a transit system. And so when folks like me keep talking and talking about the MBTA and its need for net new revenue, I point to today's discussion and this week's experience, which is to say, look, the T also needs to innovate. Everybody deserves a first-rate experience on a bus. And the only way you get there is to invest in it and make it work well. There's no transit system I know of anywhere in this country that isn't subsidized,
right?
Because it costs a lot of money. Whether that subsidy is coming from a sales tax on the public side or a private sector investment capital on the private side, it's still
a subsidy. Yeah. Yeah. Matt?
So to be clear, right, the reason that companies like us require outside investment and things like that is not to fund operations, Jim. Right. I feel like that's a point that we need to make. But because we're investing in machine learning scientists, software engineers, and other things to be able to take the vehicle and the efficiencies that we were able to show and expand that out even further. So I think it's a very fair argument of saying robust investment in public transit. And you've been out there for decades, right, really talking about that. But we're in the same position that we were, right? 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. So the reason why I'm very glad to have both of you in is, quite frankly, I'm just going to fully disclose to listeners, I was kind of apoplectic yesterday. I was like, why can't Bridge at least is proving that the idea of a smart bus system is, I mean, okay, the financial question aside, is technically viable. I mean, it was like proving it every day. So I was just frothing at the mouth. Why can't we take some of those lessons and really use it to develop the MBTA bus system for the future?
Well, I think we can. I mean, the whole point of innovation is that you learn from things, right? Innovation doesn't always mean things are successful, but it means that ideas, things can be learned, right? Lessons learned. I have been advocating, and many of us advocate, for the MBTA to embark upon a new era of bus transit called Bus Rapid Transit, or BRT. And that would be a game changer in the city of Boston, the city of Cambridge, around the region. We can do that most affordably. It's the most affordable way to enliven, expand, modernize, and improve the transit experience for people in greater Boston.
Yeah.
And I think there are many people, including the Barr Foundation, putting a lot of effort toward getting folks at the state level and the city level committed to bringing our bus transit system into the 21st century. Mm.
You know, I know this sounds pie in the sky, but I'm genuinely wondering, like, some of the long-term, very legitimate critiques of MBTA bus service in particular, like it's the poor stepchild of the commuter rail and the trains, and also bus service is not infrequently the worst in places that need it the most, right? In underserved communities. And to me, I don't necessarily believe, I'm not a techno-utopianist, Matthew, in any way, shape, or form, but I just thought on-demand pricing and scheduling could solve that problem, right? The buses could go where the demand is needed, in communities that are clamoring for better transit. So I suppose that's my editorial rant. But let me just ask you, I'm going to just hope that Joe Shortsleeve is listening to this. And if he is, and he has the brilliant idea of hiring you now since you're free, do you think it's possible to scale what Bridge was doing city or region-wide? Like, what would it take to put this system grafted onto the MBTA?
Yeah, I think it takes also, to be clear, right, we were scaling. We were growing about 1,000% year over year. But in order to be able to deliver the service robustly, right, throughout the entire city, especially to the folks that need it, if you look at the Brookings study a couple years ago that said the average Bostonian can only access about 28% of the jobs that they're qualified for via 90 minutes of public transit, unless we really rethink how we're providing public transit all over the country, we're still not going to get the economic mobility that we want, right, in cities, if we're limiting people's physical mobility.
But so what would it take to scale it all the way up to an MBTA-sized
So in order to be able to scale it to the MBTA, right, and to the size of the MBTA, it really takes from the top down a really new look, right, at how we deliver service and getting out of the no, we can't, right, and into the yes, we can type environment of service delivery. I think one of the things that Brian Shortsleeve and Governor Baker have been tremendous about is saying, bringeth thou ideas, right, and let's start to integrate it for the people who need it the most. For instance, late night service. When you're looking at those people who need to get to jobs and don't have a way of doing that, we proposed an alternative. Jim was against it. But at the end of the day, we need to try new things.
Yeah. And by the way, you corrected me on Brian's name. Thank you.
No worries.
By the way, I'm getting my short sleeves confused.
No, I'm not against. I wasn't against late night service. Transit Matters, the board I serve on, we've been critical to actually making it happen. Look, you need to do things that we're not doing now. Buses need to have their own dedicated lanes. You need to have people paying off the bus.
Yeah.
There are lots of things we could do very quickly to make the bus experience a better one. So people like me have been advocating for that. You can have all the good intentions in the world, but if you don't have the money to do it and the resources to make it happen and the will to do things like take lanes out of parking to make a dedicated bus lane and enforce it, then we're not going to have the kind of experience that we all want.
So infrastructure needs also.
It's a new way of thinking about it. You need to take the infrastructure that is dedicated to vehicles and parking and rededicate it in some respect to transit mobility, which is carrying many, many more people. It's a much more sustainable way to move people from one place to another.
Yeah. Matthew, let me ask you, I don't know if you were able to launch it or it was in the works, some larger scale stuff in Kansas City, is that right?
Yeah, we're really proud of that, yeah.
So was it just, you know, Bridge in Kansas City where you were partnering with the city's transit system there? What were you doing?
To your last question about how do you scale it to a city-sized transit agency, we had a one-year federally funded pilot program in Kansas City that we did in cooperation with the Kansas City Area Transit Authority and in cooperation with research partners at the University of California, Berkeley. The exciting part of that was the vehicles were owned by the city. The drivers in the driver's seat were amalgamated transit unionized drivers, and the fare was set by the city. In Kansas City, we were able to prove that we could take the operating cost down per bus hour from about $220 down to about $68 while serving on a per capita basis more people with higher headways than the traditional network. And that's all publicly available through the UC Berkeley study that's been put out there. But at the end of the day, it's Kansas City, right, which was built around the car. The overall numbers were incredibly low. But on the per unit basis, there was a significant amount of improvement.
Right. Jim, did you want to just jump in here again?
Do I want to talk about Kansas City? No, I don't want to talk.
You want to talk about Boston?
I want to talk about Boston.
Yeah.
But it's an example. It's an example of how cities can actually do it.
That's what I'm wondering. If we're seeing sort of tantalizing examples, and again, all the differences that Matthew pointed out, points taken on that, because they matter here. But I mean, I don't see why, again, with the will, why we couldn't try something like that.
Well, we could. I mean, look, I don't want to debate with Matthew whether Kansas City was a success or not. Let me just say, in Boston, in greater Boston, at the MBTA, there's a lot that you could do today. There are very smart people I just wrote about who work at the T, who are technologists, who can help guide us to a future where the T is behaving more like a 21st century institution. What we've got to do is get past the old ways of thinking. We have to stop thinking about the bus as a vehicle fighting in the same traffic as every other vehicle. We need to think about transit as a sustainable form of mobility that more and more people desire and that hasn't been properly invested in for decades. And we need to think about doing things that are not really about technology, like dedicating lanes, right? And we need to think about pushing information to people on smartphones, which is technology. All of that stuff can be done right away and today. It's just a question of how do we think about it. The problem that we've got in the public sector, of course, is that people are always playing catch-up because there's so much to do. There's so much on their plate. There's a $7.3 billion gap in state of good repair. But, you know, we've got to figure out how to multitask.
Right.
And so my plea to people is let's support the T in multitasking and get some of these innovations happening so that people will like it and we'll be able to do more of it.
Right. I mean, I can imagine there are a lot of listeners right now who are like, Magna, why are you talking about pie in the sky ideas when we do have very real immediate term problems with the tea? And I am aware of those. So Jim's touched on a lot of that. And why can't we do it both? Agreed. Matthew, just last quick question for you. So what's next?
I don't know yet. What I'm focused on over the next 2 weeks is making sure that our drivers find their next chapter. We were the first and only startup to sign on to the Fight for 15 pledge to make sure that our drivers were paid very well with a livable wage and good health care. And my sole goal over the next couple weeks is making sure those drivers find their next opportunity.
Well, Matthew George is the founder and CEO of Bridge, which sadly is no longer. But Matthew, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you so much.
And Jim Aloisi, former State Secretary of Transportation and now a principal at the Pemberton Square Group. It's always great to talk with you, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's a crisis in forensic science going on, namely mounting evidence that forensics rely on flawed science and that experts overstate their accuracy in court. Take, for example, hair analysis, once a commonly trusted tool in criminal trials. You know, when an expert would testify that they found strands of hair on the victim that matched the perpetrator's hair. Well, this was before DNA analysis came on the scene, and it turns out that hair analysis without the DNA part is very subjective and potentially very flawed, even though it was used by the FBI for more than 30 years. That's why in 2013, the Obama administration launched the National Commission on Forensic Science, an independent committee charged with improving the reliability of forensics and creating uniform standards across the country. Well, last month, Attorney General Jeff Sessions disbanded the commission. Sessions said the Justice Department will conduct its own review of forensic science. We're joined now by one of the commission's former members, Suzanne Bell. She's a chemistry and forensic science professor at West Virginia University. Suzanne Bell, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, you and five other commission members wrote a letter to Attorney General Sessions asking him to renew the commission's charter. He did not. But what do you worry will happen without the work that the commission was doing?
Well, we're concerned about the loss of the commission because it was the first large-scale effort on the national level to get essentially all the players in the room. We had everybody from defense and prosecution through victims' advocates and the group that signed the letter, which included me, which were independent academic scientists.
Yeah.
And we found that it was once we got to know each other and to work together, it was actually very productive because those groups have – on occasion spent more time talking past each other than to each other. So it was a very good bringing together of different expertise.
Mm. I mean, you know, I at the beginning of our conversation, I said that forensic science is in a crisis. That's my take on the situation. Do you agree? Is there a crisis going on?
Crisis, I'm not sure I would say crisis, but certainly we're at a turning point and a critical turning point because there has been an awful lot of progress since the 2008 report by the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council, which started to bring a lot of that to light.
Well, if I can just jump in here,
sure.
that report basically took to task almost every one of the familiar aspects of forensic science that we know about: fingerprinting, firearms identification, bite mark analysis, blood spatter, hair, handwriting. They found that almost all of them were scientifically unsound.
Certainly the ones that are based in pattern evidence have different levels of having gone through the validation progress. But other disciplines that aren't maybe as well known, for example, the forensic chemistry, which has been going on for many, many years, has gone through a little bit different crucible. It's interesting because the disciplines that were highlighted, the pattern evidence disciplines, really were developed more as a tool for law enforcement, where things like DNA came out of the traditional scientific process of research and then being adopted by the community, much as chemistry did.
I see.
So those disciplines didn't really have the same scientific birthing, if you will, as the other, the chemistry and DNA.
Right. You know, what's interesting, though, is that, of course, in a court of law, we're asking a jury of one's peers to weigh the evidence, right? And they are relying on testimony from from experts. So I think that that's part of the problem here is that there was this sense that juries weren't qualified enough, not out of any fault of their own, but to really be able to accurately and fairly weigh the evidence when so much of the science was uncertain.
Certainly, yeah. That's one of the great ironies of this system, because if you look at it, we're asking judges and juries to make decisions on science, which is really difficult. It's almost – it's in a sense, it's kind of crazy. It's like asking me to weigh in on precedent or legal decisions. And as science and technology have advanced, that problem's got even worse. So it's – that's one of the things that came up in the commission is that in many ways, science and the law are different. We think of them as using truth, but really the methodology is different.
Yeah.
You know, the legal system is based on argument. The scientific system is based on different versions of the scientific method. And those two don't – it's not – it's a shotgun marriage at best.
Right. You know, one of the things that Attorney General Sessions said is that much of the forensic analysis or forensic science is done at the state level anyway, implying that he didn't feel the need to have a set of robust national standards. I mean, he has a point there. Of course, we here in Massachusetts, when we think of state forensic analysis, it's a complicated issue here in this state. But to the AG's broader point, what do you make of that?
Well, it's absolutely true. Most of the forensic analysis does occur at the state and local level. And the federal laboratories that are under the Department of Justice in many ways are model laboratories. I mean, they also have resources that the state and local laboratories don't have. And that's one point that I think is often missing is an understanding by the public of how much it costs to do something even like accreditation, which I think everybody in the forensic science community agrees is important, and there's no doubt about that. But that takes resources, time, and money, and more than goodwill. And I think forensic science needs the national platform to help folks get the resources that they need to do the right thing.
Yeah. You know, again, in Massachusetts, we can't help but to think of what happened with Annie Ducan and the fact that more than 21,000 cases, criminal cases, were thrown out because of the actions of her, just one chemist, and all the evidence that she handled and falsification of lab results, et cetera. I mean, that was a systemic failure here in the state of Massachusetts. I mean, is there anything that you know, your commission could have done or would have looked at that may have addressed things like that?
Well, certainly one accreditation would have, I think, in my opinion, would have stopped that.
Yeah.
You know, you can never stop a rogue analyst completely. But accreditation has several layers of review, and it would have – you know, you have to look at that failure as a failure of management and accreditation. So that's something that the commission looked at, and indeed we made a very clear statement about supporting universal accreditation and helping laboratories to set out a pathway to accreditation in recognition of how difficult a process that is.
Hmm. Well, the Attorney General says that the Department of Justice will be conducting its own internal review. We'll see what comes out of that. But I'm just wondering, Suzanne Bell, there are a lot of people listening who one day may end up serving on juries. And what's your advice to them in terms of what to think about or how to conceive of forensic evidence if it's ever presented to them in court?
Well, it's a difficult thing. And part of our job as witnesses is to be educators in that sense. We have to do the best we can to educate the jury so they can properly weigh the evidence. And it's a two-stage process. It has to be admitted, and that's the case. That's the stage where we go through the review of scientific validity, and ideally what the jury hears has gone through that process and has met the requirements for that. But then it also is incumbent on the expert to do a good job of explaining, but we're not always free to do that.
Yeah.
We have to answer the prompts of the attorneys.
What do you think is at stake if the DOJ's internal review doesn't end up being as robust as the one that the commission had hoped to do?
Well, first, I think we have to wait and see how they form that review. I think the presence of independent scientists is absolutely critical. I mean, the Department of Justice is staffed with an awful lot of dedicated people, and so we're not necessarily concerned about those folks, but my feeling is, personally anyway, is in agreement with the National Academy report that forensic science needs to be independent. I mean, it needs to be independent from a prosecutorial agency just as it has to be independent from defense.
Well, Suzanne Bell is a chemistry and forensic science professor at West Virginia University. She's also a former member of the now-defunct National Commission on Forensic Science. Professor Bell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciated it.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Leveraged buyouts, maximizing profits over people, astronomical executive pay packages, creative accounting, the financialization of everything, and, well, the financial crisis itself. They are all part of a rogues gallery of questionable corporate practices over the past many decades. And financial journalist Duff McDonald says there's one thing that binds them all together: Harvard Business School. In his new book, The Golden Passport, McDonald casts a supercritical eye over the business school's century-long history and asks, is Harvard Business School complicit and even responsible for the moral failings of American capitalism? Duff McDonald joins us now from NPR in New York. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So you've gone after the biggest of the big here in terms of business schools. Why Harvard? Do you really believe that it's at the core of the failing of capitalism in America?
Harvard is one of the oldest and largest and most influential of the business schools, and arguably has had the most influence of all of them. The book could be seen as a criticism of modern MBA teaching in general, but so many of the genealogy strands of it lead back to HBS that it serves as a good enough central character.
Yeah. So let me ask you, though. In the book, you write about how at the founding or the creation of Harvard Business School, there was this sense, this idea that a question of moral leadership should be, you know, a part of what is taught there. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Before the school was founded, the people who were in support of the idea, the first people that had to get the idea passed were the overseers of Harvard itself, and they met with initial resistance, which I guess you could characterize as, we don't do trade schools. You know, we're about a life of the mind here, not about the daily grind. And the response to that from the founders of HBS was, oh, no, we're not interested in, teaching bookkeeping or making treasurers. We want to educate an enlightened managerial elite that understands its responsibilities not just to their companies but to the rest of society.
Mm-hmm.
And the Harvard folks were like, oh, now you're talking a kind of Harvard idea. And I think what happened is, if what you're really about is career acceleration and maximizing earnings potential, you know, there's nothing to be ashamed of about those things. But you hardly want to go around telling people that that's what you're all about. And so they draped over themselves this idea of a moral right to lead, and have been repeating it so often that they've convinced themselves that they are not only successful, they are right. And I think that very fact has led them astray too many times.
Well, and it's not just Harvard Business School itself that thinks it's right. I mean, American business writ large frequently thinks that Harvard is right. Otherwise, their influence wouldn't ever leave, the campus of the business school itself. I think that's one of the reasons why what you're saying here has caught so many people's interest.
Oh, sure. So look, don't get me wrong. The HBS has made many significant positive contributions to American business, including in the first half of the century laying the foundations for American managerial excellence. And they have done significant and extensive work in all sorts of disciplines, from strategy to organizational behavior, et cetera. So I in no way want to take away from those things. It's that you've kept repeating to yourselves all the good that you're doing, that you're turning a blind eye to all the downsides of what you teach and how you teach. Take, for example, you know, the whole issue of pricing in pharmaceuticals these days.
Right.
That there are executives who actually can walk into a meeting and say, you know what, it's a good idea that we should jack this up to 5-10x times what people can afford because it's good for the bottom line. The fact that that kind of thinking can even happen is, you know, you can trace it back to the moral ambiguity in the case method as taught at Harvard Business School.
So I want to dive into another specific example that you raise in the book. I mean, you look at the whole history of Harvard Business School, but there's one that I want to get much more detail from you on. And I have to say, this is someone who's still living, Michael Jensen, an economist and Harvard Business School professor who really did provide the sort of intellectual foundation for many of the business practices, which, you know, depending on who you are, you might think that they're terrible or they're foundational in America today. But, you know, he's the one who brought the intellectual reasoning behind leverage buyouts and corporate pay packages. Tell us more about why you wanted to focus on him.
Okay. Just as a preface to that, in the most recent issue of Harvard Business Review, there's an article written by a couple of HBS professors basically refuting Michael Jensen and saying it's all wrong. We don't believe that. And pretty much saying things that are in precise agreement with me. And in some of the original responses to the book, they said McDonald's focused on Michael Jensen. That's in the past. And, you know, I was focused on Michael Jensen, but when I was talking about the era of Michael Jensen.
Right.
So he basically helped yank the country towards shareholder capitalism and said stuff like golden parachutes are good for shareholders and leverage buyouts create value without any qualification. And it was the 80s and 90s, and it took us into a place where the North Star for this nation is share price.
Yeah.
HBS itself regrets that today. It's, you know, I don't know this for sure, but I don't think it's much of a coincidence that that article came out in the exact same time as my book did. And so the fact that we're in agreement on that and they say we've moved on. And my point is, well, the rest of us haven't. Right. Every major public company in this country is run for share price today. Short term decisions that value, again, profits over people. That's his legacy. That's on Harvard. The rest of us, I don't care if they've moved on. Society hasn't. And they played a huge part in getting us where we are.
Yeah. I wonder, though, is the real story here not so much what's come out of Harvard Business School, even though obviously the specifics matter, but more so that Harvard was just extraordinarily, or was and perhaps still is, extraordinarily good at doing things that come natural to, or I'm going to say, trying to figure out the right way to say this. Harvard did a great job at providing the intellectual basis to justify what people are naturally tend to do anyway. Like the powerful will seek more power. The wealthy will seek more wealth. And short of society saying no and regulating, for example, that's the natural course of things.
Right. So my response to that, if you talk about the 80s and sort of the Gordon Gekko era of greed, HBS didn't invent that, obviously. So on the one hand, HBS wants to claim influence. In this instance, they would like to not claim influence. So for the sake of argument, let's take them at their word that they weren't so influential there. Then what was their role as part of Harvard and an institution of higher learning is to try and clarify the thinking of the students and keep us honest to ourselves, right? And instead, they were cheerleaders for the moment. So either they caused it, or if they don't want to claim that influence, all they were doing was standing on the sidelines with their pom-poms rooting everyone on. They can have either one. Doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, we did reach out to Harvard Business School and to see if we could speak with Dean Nitin Noria. They declined and instead pointed us to a conversation that Dean Noria had with the Harvard Crimson. And, you know, he said things to the Crimson such as, in many ways, I think the book doesn't give justice to the many ways in which Harvard Business School is trying and has always tried to remind its graduates that as business leaders, they do have a deep and important relationship with society and that the health of society is something that is their responsibility. And I was wondering if what your reaction is to that. I mean, Harvard didn't let you talk to anyone while you were researching this book, right?
No. And I actually lost interest in what Dean Noria had to say about the book in that article after he admitted not having read it. So I'm not sure how he came by his understanding of what it omits or overstates, because he hadn't read it at that point.
Okay. So let me back up here a little bit, because I actually did speak with Dean Noria back in 2011, early on when in his deanship of Harvard Business School, because I wanted to ask him, and I did ask him back then, all these questions about ethical education and creating the next generation of ethical management and business leaders. And we had a pretty deep conversation about that. And so I just want to play one or two pieces of tape and get you to respond to that. Here he is. This is Dean Noria again. And he told me what he thought is actually wrong with management education. Again, this is in 2011.
I just felt that business education had lost this original animating purpose, and that it was time to remind us that, much like doctors have a Hippocratic Oath and lawyers care to take the bar and think about their education as animating them towards creating justice in society, that business leaders also had a responsibility of thinking that their first goal was to create prosperity for society. And if they created value for society, then they could keep value for themselves.
So, Mr. McDonald, I mean, whether or not Dean Noria has read your book yet, that's what he told me back in 2011. Does that give you a little bit of hope about leadership at Harvard Business School?
Sure. And he and I agree that they have lost sight of it and periodically lose sight of it for a long time. But and you know, it's great to say those words, but, you know, follow through would be more preferable. You know, it's interesting. There was a review in the Journal last week, of Wall Street Journal, of the book last week, and there was a letter in it today that the headline for it was "Nothing inspires envy more than success," and it suggested I should be ashamed of myself for degrading one of the world's great schools. And it's
Harvard can weather this. I mean,
yeah, it's like that kind
honest.
Of attitude, though. It's like, if your hierarchy of values is so out of whack that you think that whatever the narrow version that constitutes success for you at Harvard Business School, which tends to be money, is something that causes envy in everyone else, like, that's the whole problem here. It's that you've narrowed your thinking. The school takes these ambitious, smart, and capable young people and narrows their thinking, and when they could be widening it. Isn't that what Harvard's supposed to do?
Right. So that's the question. What are they good at versus what their actual purpose should be, right? But I mean, you don't mince words in the book at all. You basically say that American business schools as a whole, Harvard being pinnacle amongst them, are private sector madrasas. And you actually talk to Casey Gerald, who graduated a couple of years ago from Harvard Business School, and he told you that for a whole semester, the school is, quote, basically bought and paid for by the consulting firms. You can't go to lunch without seeing someone from Bain, Boston Consulting Group, or McKinsey. You know, on the other hand, some might say, what's wrong with that?
Sure. If you want to be clear about that's what you're doing, that you're basically pimping out your best graduates to Wall Street, that's fine. I wouldn't criticize you for that, but that's not what you say you're doing. So, you know, the point is, like, if you're going to convince your graduates that they are – that their whole lives are morally righteous simply by virtue of having attended Harvard Business School, which is essentially what they tell each other, then you should probably add a stronger and more apparent moral and ethical component to your teachings instead of stuff like – allowing your professors to consult for the same companies that they're supposed to be viewing objectively and explaining not be beholden to corporate money. And it's just they're so conflicted, it's hard to know where to start.
Yeah. Well, again, back in 2011 when I spoke with Dean Nathan Noria, he did talk about trying to figure out ways to create conversations, in his words, that allow business students to think harder about the responsibilities they have to society.
Hang on.
With you, right? But hang on here, yeah. Because then we also talked with Eugene Soltis. He's a professor at Harvard Business School. He wrote a book about white-collar criminals, and I asked him about teaching more ethics in business school, and here's what he said.
The trouble is that the time they spend thinking about this, it's ultimately 2 years, or in an ethics class, it's 40 or 50 hours in the classroom. Let's say they go to work at a bank. That's equivalent to their first 3 days of work. This is where one of the challenges that we face is, how do you get back that spirit? How do you rekindle those things that you might have been thinking when you had the time to step back and think?
We just have 10 seconds, really, Duff McDonald. Your final takeaway on the challenges of creating socially responsible business leaders?
I wish Dean Noria well. I hope he does the job he said he set out to do. It'd be great if he did, but he's not doing it at this point.
Well, Duff McDonald's new book is The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism, and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.